Welcome to The Gary Knoll Show, an informative program dedicated to improving personal and public health.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're here to talk about issues that make a difference in our lives. Today, we're going to explore a lot. We're going to talk about something that I know everyone will appreciate. Learning how to change sublimation, like overeating or drinking or complaining or overworking, by examining its underlying causes. This is going to help everyone in this audience. And we're also going to talk about the gift of ADHD. Now, last week, I did a program called The Edison Gene, and it was a provocative and challenging hypothesis that explores what if these kids who have been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD actually have a uniqueness. They shouldn't be chemically controlled. Rather, they should be understood and nurtured. And because we're not all the same, we have unique differences. And there was a time when we were allowed to express those differences. Do you think that the people who are the great artists, the great writers, the poets, the sculptors, the business people, the philosophers, do you think that they're the normal kids who just act like everyone else? They live a normal 9-to-5 existence? Not at all. These are people who frequently are at the extreme edges of society on so many levels. That doesn't mean they're crazy. Doesn't mean that they need to be institutionalized or given some drug. They need to be understood. So that was the nature of that program. Today we're going to have a little different look. We're going to look at our relationship to our, well, the relationship that our soul creates, the life events that happen to us. The way we relate to our soul will be the way our world relates to us. If we are forever disciplining and limiting ourselves, so the world responds by disciplining and limiting at us. If we are generously giving ourselves permission to feel what we want to feel for as long as we need to feel, then this generosity will be reflected back to us in life events. Now we need to find out how we can get this generous with our children. My guest to share this journey today is Dr. Laura Honus Webb. Dr. Webb has been assistant professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University. She was the senior research psychologist at the Department of Psychiatry at San Francisco Veterans Affairs Medical Center and has an appointment at Northern California Institute for Research and Education. She is currently an adjunct research faculty member at the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Webb.
Hi, Gary.
How are you?
Real good. How are you doing?
Good. Why do you feel that kids who have ADHD have a special skill set? And what examples can you give us? And take your time, go into depth on this.
Yeah, I think that children who end up with a diagnosis of ADHD actually have an enormous amount of gifts to offer our world, and they're gifts that, as a society, we're desperately in need of. I talk about the 5 gifts of ADHD, and of course there's more than that, but this is a way of kind of highlighting these special gifts that our culture is in particular need of. One of the gifts would be creativity, and in fact, all of the symptoms of ADHD could also be thought of similarly as creativity. And I think that this is pointing a way to a transformation in our culture where we have moved from sort of the industrial age or even the day of where people spend a lifetime at one career, at one business. Well, we live in the digital age where what we need is creativity and the world moves at a faster pace. And rather than being able to follow through on instructions that other people give us, What we need is searching insight and powerful imagination. And this is one of the gifts that ADHD has to offer.
Now, add something to that, please. With each one of these examples, give us actual illustrations of how a person can really use that gift, if we understood it as a gift and not as a problem.
Yeah. So let me give this. I have worked with individuals given this diagnosis both as a professor and also as a clinician. And really the insight came to me more as a teacher, because in the clinical consulting room, you're looking for problems. As a teacher, I can compare a wide group of people and see how they compare. So let me give you an example of the gift and how we can use that, and how one of my ultimate points of my book is that actually children with ADHD are like canaries in the mine. You know this metaphor where miners used to take canaries down with them so that when the oxygen got too low, the canaries would die first, and then that was a sign that everyone had to get out. Well, my metaphor is that children with this diagnosis are like that, and that their problems are not a reflection of some biochemical disorder, but rather it's a cry that our educational system needs to be changed. So let me give you some concrete examples. I teach a class, and I have a lot of students that don't have ADHD, and they may come in to my office hours, and typically they want to know what's going to be on the test, and or on page 23 it says this, and page 26 it says something different. Whereas a person with ADHD in my class will come in, and actually I will learn something from them, because they're more interested in pushing the limits of what I'm talking about rather than mastering it in a way that they can regurgitate. So some example you might see if you were, I teach at the university level, let's say you were teaching at a lower level, is a teacher gets up and he's lecturing on photosynthesis or something. And a child with ADHD may be thinking, wow, what happens if there's clouds out? You know, what happens to the plants then? Is there some way to get the sun to the plants, even if there's clouds out? And they'll take it in a new direction, and they'll be thinking about problems and how we could solve these problems. Whereas a person who doesn't have ADHD may be sitting there and memorizing, you know, the components of photosynthesis and concerned about remembering that there was a quiz at the end of the week and that they better, you know, remember all the words in the labels. So, and so you can see that if you're in an education system that wants you to regurgitate the facts, you're going to do better if you're the student who remembers that there's a quiz. But in the real world, you are the student with ADHD is already moving ahead thinking, what were the problems with this and how could we solve those problems? So that would be one example of creativity. I think the second example, one of the second gifts is exuberance. And what, you know, what might be called hyperactivity, I would call exuberance. And it really, to me, this one brings to mind really one of the deep, ironies of this diagnosis, which is that I think calling a child who has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is calling that so many disorders, is much like saying that a woman has a penis deficit hypermammary disorder, meaning that you're taking differences and you're turning them into disorders. And it is particularly highlighted with this one of exuberance. So many adults can think of, for example, you come home on a Friday night, you've had a long day at work, and all you want to do maybe is order pizza and sit in front of the TV because you're exhausted. And actually, in a culture where we have chronic fatigue disorder and all of these other major depression and addictions as rampant, how is it that this quality of having too much energy has become a medical disorder, especially in children? So I think to me this is really one of the key places where there is a problem with this diagnosis. And I do acknowledge in my book that there certainly is, you know, that the disorder gets out of control in a lot of ways and behavior does become problematic, but that a lot of times the problematic behavior comes not from the energy levels but from the child's reasonable reaction to being constantly punished in a school environment, or it could even be in the family environment. Wherever the child is experiencing punishment, And also the hit that these children take when they get a diagnosis. All they hear is deficit disorder, and there's something really wrong with me. And that channels their high levels of energy into problematic expression sometimes. But when you really look at what's there, it's a lot of energy, and this can be channeled for really good things. So in some ways, this is just obvious. And I give examples in the book of, you know, you have a child that's running, you know, you have to take one of your kids to a doctor, and your other kid's running around the doctor's office tearing it up, and this is, seems like a big problem. And so I talk about ways that you can honor their exuberance and even channel it in different ways. And, for example, you might want to say, well, you know, how about you and your, you can plan on using your energy tonight. We can talk about ways that you could, you know, when we were getting here today, I couldn't find my keys. Maybe you and your dad could find a way to solve this problem of why am I always losing my keys, and you could go to the hardware shop and build something to help solve this problem. And then you let the child start planning and using their energy in these different ways. And so this is just one other example, and there's lots of techniques for helping to amplify that. But really, more important, I think, than the behavioral intervention is increasing for the parent and the child the awareness of how these traits are gifts, and then not only increasing that awareness that they're gifts, but also sort of changing their self-perceptions. And I believe that fundamental to helping these children express their gifts in ways that do not disturb others is this transformation of both the parent and the child to a positive perception of these differences. And also that this same thing will create a close connection between the child and the parent, and that's fundamental. One of the third gifts that I'm going to talk about is interpersonal intuition. And I think anyone who's had any close experience with people with this diagnosis are usually really caught off guard by how much intuition they have. And as you can imagine, a lot of time it gets them into trouble. One example I can think of is one of my students that I was supervising was running a group of group therapy. And there was this woman in the group who had been given the diagnosis of ADHD, and she had really disrupting the group. And this therapist in training talked about how she could not manage this behavior and was getting more and more anxious. And the more anxious she got, the more disruptive the behavior got. And then she talks about the day she just walked into the group and she said, there's nothing I can do about this. This is a therapist. And she said, I can't turn this around. I'm just going to have to, you know, make my way through this. And it was, and that very day, the young woman that had been given the diagnosis of ADHD radically changed her behavior and calmed down. And the therapist realized that what had happened was that this young woman with ADHD had been picking up on the therapist's anxiety and acting it out. And she also came to the realization that she thought that this was the most superficial young woman in the group. And on reflection, she realized that this was the woman that was the most connected to her because she was sensing and feeling her anxiety, but as a young woman was sort of acting it out rather than finding some way to communicate about it. And then the fourth gift is emotional sensitivity. And again, you know, this is what kids tend to get in trouble for, whether it be anger outbursts or, you know, maybe picking on other kids or what this seems to be these displays of intense emotion. Well, this can also be thought of and is in many different disciplines, whether it be the arts or spirituality, spiritual pursuits, is an obvious gift. And again, because it gets punished and treated in ways that are in some ways destructive, it takes forms that can become problematic and disruptive to other people. But at its root, we would think of it as a tremendous gift. So an example of this might be, a young boy goes to the store with his mom and wants to buy and picks off this huge novel of science fiction off of the shelf and says to his mom that this is what he wants. And she says, no, you know, you can't get that. It's not appropriate. And he kind of throws himself down on the ground and just says, you know, how can this be? How can this be? Well, in some ways, you know, this is, it's an expression of his disappointment. And, you know, depending on how the mother handles it at that point, it can become an enormous gift or it can become a problem. And, but, for example, if the mother says, yeah, I understand that this is a disappointment to you, and, you know, and honors his emotional sensitivity, that that's appropriate developmentally, and allows him to feel the frustration, but also honors it, then he will come out, then this child will recognize and honor their own emotional experiences, which will guide them through their whole life. Because what we know is that emotions are messages to us, and it speaks in this case to this boy's intense desire to learn and to, you know, in this case, his fascination for science fiction. And then finally, the last gift is what I call ecological consciousness. And there has been research out there by that has been published, and it has shown that if you give children with ADHD time in nature, and this just isn't just activity, so for example, if they play on a basketball court, they won't get the same benefits, but if they play in nature, in green environments, they will, you'll see statistically significant reductions in ADHD symptoms. And through some of my own research in interviewing these students, what I find is they feel very connected to nature. Sometimes when they're not paying attention in class, they're looking out the window at the trees, at the dogs, at the birds. They have this immediate connection to the natural world. And as you can probably imagine, in our culture today, this is a gift that the world really needs. People who are sensitive to the environment, interested in protecting it, and feel an immediate, direct attunement to it. So that's kind of the overall summary of the five gifts.
I appreciate you going into that depth. Let me share a few thoughts, and then we'll go to another part of this issue. When I was growing up and I was in junior high school, I had a teacher that would allow my buddy and I to put on skits. We'd get up and joke, and we were always clowning around. Now, she had a choice. She could have reprimanded us and sent us down to this very strict principal, would have whacked us and thrown us out of school. Or she said, well, why don't you have everyone laugh at your cut-ups? And we did. And so on a regular basis, we had put on all these very creative little impromptu funny things, and the kids were laughing, and everybody had a good time. And I thought, my goodness, what a very insightful teacher. You couldn't hold us in the seats. We were always joking about something because we just had a lot of fun. Now, you get two people together, three people together who share common energy, they're going to be acting out and cutting up all the time. When I got into college, it was different. I couldn't afford college. I didn't come from a background where they could give you any money at all. And there was this notion in high school that if you didn't come from a well-to-do background, you certainly weren't going to go to a good college, not to an Ivy League college, and you're going to work at some menial job. And it was just expected. It was assumed. If you came in on the yellow buses from the country, you never heard of anyone from the yellow buses going to college or doing well, unless it was on an athletic scholarship because they were big old boys. And if you came from a middle class background, maybe you went to a state university. More often than not, if you're a woman, you got married. These were expected outcomes. And then when I did go to college and I realized the only way I could afford to stay in there is if I got an athletic scholarship and or a sports scholarship, I tried for both, and I had to make the dean's list, and which I was able to do. But I also, because then my whole attitude changed, because then I had to learn. I didn't like the material. I couldn't stand some of the class, didn't like the way that they taught, but this was what you had to do. And then I also got an athletic scholarship. I played basketball in college, and which was no easy matter since I was the shortest guy on the team. So I had to compensate by being faster and fearless. And And I was able to do that. And I learned some lessons that we don't always have people who help us adjust to the situation that we're in. And so therefore, parents will frequently look at us as underachieving and then apologize for us rather than being advocates for us. And I'd like to see parents be advocates instead of apologists. I'd like to see more school teachers look at the child not as a series of symptoms to which you can give a quick diagnosis and then quickly follow with Ritalin, but rather for every kid that looks out the window, that acts up in class, that's always goofing off like me, and why not look at the potential that kid may have, that maybe that kid doesn't have the same thing going on in their brain. Now you look back, and I was the least likely to succeed at anything in school. I'm lucky they didn't put me in a straitjacket and give me electroconvulsive therapy every day.
Right.
But today, with 80 books published, more bestsellers than anyone in the history of the world on health and nutrition, and 100 documentaries and 17,000 broadcasts and all the other things I've done, that could not have happened, would not have happened at all had I not believed that my life was more important outside the classroom than inside the classroom. I couldn't wait to get outside that classroom. And with some school teachers that I really appreciated most, I didn't. And I was bored to death. And I know I'm not the only kid to be sitting in a class looking out the window and wondering, God, when's this class going to be over? But then I could do it. Today, the poor kid who was sitting where I was sitting and would be labeled and drugged. And my goodness, how many other kids who could help us in our lives and our world are going to be put into some classification and not allowed to help us because of that way of not understanding what it is to be a kid. And by the way, at least when I grew up as a baby boomer, you could still actually be a kid. You didn't have to be an overperforming little adult.
Right.
Your thoughts, please.
One of the big themes in my book is this distinction you're talking about between being an apologist for your child and being an advocate. And I actually take it even a step further, which is that both parents and children should become social activists to transform the educational system and make it so that it's not just that it's not serving children with ADHD, it's not even serving our current culture. With its emphasis on rote memorization and conformity and compliance, that was fine when people would be expected to go out into jobs and work for a company for the rest of their life, and following someone's orders was what they had to learn. But in our culture, where what we need is to save our environment, where we need to have people that have this intuition, where, in the digital age, we need creativity, we need to have people who can change tracks quickly and can solve problems. This is the emphasis in what our culture needs, and this is what these children have to offer. And so to the extent that they can transform parents and children to become advocates, they're also acting as social advocates. So it could be as simple as, even some of those simple things that you said about your own experience, if teachers, rather than punishing these children and medicating them, whether it's letting them do a little comedy skit, or rather than punishing them by taking them away from recesses, giving them more time in nature, asking them to contribute, well, what are you thinking about this, and recognizing that their insights and imaginations are giving another perspective. So I really do take it maybe even a step further, that it's really sweeping changes are needed in the educational system. And it's not that teachers are bad. In fact, it's our ideas about teachers. We expect them to be a guard, a nanny, a subject expert, administrator, and big classrooms with few resources, it's not acceptable. And we also have the technology today to change school systems in ways that, in some ways, don't even take more resources. Children want to learn on the Internet and explore individualized topics instead of having to rote memorize things. And then this way, the teachers don't have to keep the attention of a large group of children. Some radical scholars of education have proposed that having a four-day school week where children can learn from a computer at home would serve everyone's interests, the teachers, the less resources, and also children's attention spans.
One last question for you. What are the documented dangers of Ritalin and other drugs used for ADHD, and why are we hypocritical to put our kids on ADHD when we criminalize heroin and cocaine, which are in the same classification as Ritalin?
That's an excellent point. There is a big discrepancy between the pharmaceutical companies and, for example, one of the federal agencies, the Drug Enforcement Agency. The Drug Enforcement Agency classifies methylphenidate, which is the main component of these drugs, as a Schedule II drug. That's the same class as heroin and cocaine. And in fact, the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the most prestigious journals out there, in 2001 published a study that said that Ritalin is more potent than cocaine in some of its activation, and that in many ways it's just like cocaine. That was in August 2001. That study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Also, there are emerging studies showing that it stunts growth. Parents and practitioners have noticed for many years, anecdotally, that children on Ritalin were not growing. But really, even the strongest advocates of the medical model have to admit and have admitted that really the state of the science and art is that we have no scientific evidence of the long-term impact of Ritalin on these children. And the other analogy I like to use is that in the early 1900s, Freud found that using cocaine with his depressed patients was an amazingly effective treatment. And I would argue that we're in the same state today with these ADHD treatments, that actually when you look at the studies, they do show that it is effective. And you can easily imagine that similar cocaine would be effective in treating depression. But we also know that it's very destructive, in that it's addictive, and so is methylphenidate. It's an amphetamine. So it's a very addictive drug. And just as we would sort of ridicule any doctor who tried to treat depression with cocaine, I think that many years from now, people may look back at our current emphasis on medicating these children with the same sort of, how could they have done that?
I hope it doesn't take that long. Do you have a website?
I do. I have a website. It's www.visionarysoul.com. You can learn about my book, The Gift of ADHD, there, and other applications of my perspective on this.
Sure do appreciate you being on today.
Yeah, thank you, Gary.
All the best.
Okay, bye.
Bye. That's Professor Laura Hannos Webb, W-E-B-B, and she's assistant professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University, and formerly also senior research psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry, San Francisco, Veterans Affairs Medical Center. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us. In this segment of our program, we're going to take a look at something that really deserves attention, and that is, do vaccines mean that you are immunized or protected against what they are vaccinating you? So if you get the measles vaccine, the implication is that it would stimulate antibodies in your body so that you would be protected if you come into contact with measles. Same way with smallpox, chickenpox, or diphtheria, whooping cough, etc. Now that is the message that has been given for a long time. But there are those who believe that that message has been oversold or is simply inaccurate. Tim O'Shea is a researcher, doctor of chiropractor, who's been in private practice in San Jose, California. And he also does a lot of research. And he's here to talk about the sanctity of human blood. Vaccination is not immunization. That is his new work. Nice to have you with us today, Tim.
Thank you, Gary.
Tim, tell us the difference between vaccination and immunization.
Okay. These two words are used synonymously, but it's kind of like it's a semantic trick. There's a big difference between vaccination and immunization. First of all, taking immunization, in order to become immune to something, that only happens one way. Either we must get a disease or be exposed to a disease. For example, when baby boomers got the measles, they were then immune to measles for life. Because they were exposed to the disease. The body put together the steps of immunization by itself in ways about which science has only the vaguest inkling. Now contrast this, immunization, contrast this with the concept of vaccination. What is vaccination? all vaccination means is that you take a man-made substance, which we call a vaccine, you put it in a syringe, and you inject it into the human body. That's vaccination. But in practice, because of this sort of semantic trick that we are subject to, we ask each other, did you take your child in for his immunizations today? When what you mean is, did you take your child in for his vaccinations? These are two entirely different concepts. And just because you get vaccinated, that may have nothing to do with you being immunized.
Okay, thank you. Tell us now about what goes into the vaccines. What are the combinations and compositions of these vaccines, all right?
Sure. The ingredients of vaccines, there's a lot of misinformation in this field, too, especially from the New Age arena. And so in my book, The Sanctity of Human Blood, I've determined only to list things that I can document. So to answer this question, what is in vaccines, we must go to the real resource, which is the physician's desk reference, and that is the manufacturer's manual. This is where they are required to disclose the exact ingredients in vaccines. So from the 2004 PDR, we read, here are some of the components in vaccines today. Attenuated organisms, toxoids, ethylene glycol, which many of us know to be a component of antifreeze, formaldehyde, aluminum, and mercury.
Okay. Let's go through now another area. Talk about vaccines possibly being dangerous. Which vaccines? What is the evidence you have? And be very detailed.
The evidence about vaccines being dangerous. Okay. That's a very broad question, but in general, there are the two primary...
Take any vaccine you want. DPT, take, pertussis, diphtheria, tetanus. That's one that's very problematic.
DPT is a good one to take because if you look at the CDC's website on the VAERS data, that's the vaccine injury compensation data, there has been about $1.4 billion paid out in vaccine damages since the program was set up in 1991. According to the CDC itself, 75% of that money has been paid out for injuries from the DPT vaccine. So a lot of times people ask me, they say, well, doc, if I were just going to skip one vaccine for my child, which one would it be? And I say, don't ask me, let's ask the government. The government says 75% of the money ever been paid out for vaccine injuries has been paid out for DPT. Probably the reason for that, the most obvious reason for that is that DPT vaccine contains mercury in it, and it always has since its inception in the mid-40s. Thimerosal is mercury in vaccines. It's an organic form of mercury which may be hundreds or thousands of times more bindable to human tissue and therefore more toxic than, you know, simple inorganic mercury, which is what we find in a thermometer or like environmental mercury that's in fish. This type of mercury that's in vaccines, the ethyl mercury, the thimerosal, is engineered so that it can bind to human tissues, and it prefers nerve tissue. It prefers to lodge in the brain. And new research from the University of Calgary that was shown in Dan Burton's congressional hearing has shown that the smallest amounts of mercury can diminish or can kill neurons as they form. It can inhibit the formation of neurons, and the way it does that is it inhibits the proteins which form the myelin, which is the lining of the individual neurons in the child's brain.
Okay. Let's go a little further. Talk about the link between mercury and autism as you know it today.
Okay. So the link between mercury and autism, it's been, it's been sort of a mantra, or you just turned the echo machine back on. Whatever you did, just turn it off, please. It's been sort of repeated over and over again in mainstream media that there has, the echo machine's on again, that there's been no real proof that mercury can cause autism. But what is abundant in the scientific literature is demonstrations and clinical controlled sciences showing the exact physiologic mechanism on the neurology of humans when mercury is introduced into the system. And a really good source for this right off the bat is on February 9th, 2004. I'm sure you know about the Institutes of Medicine. They held that conference on the effects of mercury on the human body, in which they invited 13 or 15 world-class experts to Washington to testify about the effects of mercury in the human body. And Mark Geyer, I think he was the last one who spoke at that. But in this incredible conference, one after another of the world's top scientists showed their incontrovertible data of what mercury does in the human body, not just, well, of course, on the formative neurology of a child, in which we are inhibiting interneurons from being made on the formative sections of the child's brain. And they use the analogy of, it's like, let's say you go to Fry's and you buy a new computer, right? And let's say that you open up the computer and the computer has all these wires inside, all these miles of wires, and the wires have this white sort of plastic insulation. What would it be like if at random all many of these wires within your new computer had little cuts, random cuts in the insulation of the wire that would allow random crosstalk between the wires? How would that computer operate? And it's a very good analogy to describe what is going on in the formative neurology of infants, where when in the presence of mercury and aluminum and other toxins in vaccines, we're talking about these children's brains are not even formed yet. They're in the process of formation, and the correct formation is inhibited, is prevented from happening by the presence of mercury and aluminum at that time.
Okay, good. I appreciate that insight. Now, last question for you. Let's talk about the number of vaccines that children are exposed to today. Which of those do you feel are excessive? Which do you feel are all right?
Well, when you and I were kids, Gary, we only got a couple of vaccines. Today's children who follow the mandated schedule of vaccines receive 40-plus vaccines. And this schedule you can look at on a CDC website. It's on page 50 of my new book, The Sanctity of Human Blood. It's incredible that the number of vaccines that American children are being subjected to today. No other country, we have the most vaccinated children not only in the world, but we have the most vaccinated children in the history of the world. And the problem is, it's going in the wrong direction. In January 2002, in the journal Pediatrics, Paul Offit, who's a member of the FDA Advisory Board, authored this article, sort of like tranquilizing parents and readers of this article. Oh, yes, we know that the children are getting a lot of vaccines these days, but don't worry. According to the findings of this study, an infant can tolerate up to 10,000 vaccines at any one time. And it's just incredible that you could read something like that in a peer-reviewed journal. So I talk about the money behind vaccines in my full-day seminar and in my book, and you can see it's very obvious to see the huge economic motivation behind the approval of every year more and more vaccines.
Okay, well, Tim, I appreciate you being on and sharing these insights with us. Dr. Tim O'Shea, my guest. I'm Gary Nall. Let's see if our final panelist is up here. If Dr. Mark Geier, G-E-I-R-I-E-R, he is an MD, PhD, a geneticist, and he also has worked in the fields of molecular and cellular biology, genetic engineering at the National Institutes of Health for 10 years and has been a professor at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. Do we have Dr. Geier on the phone? All right, we'll get Dr. Geier here in just a second. And then the last segment I want to go into is children with attention deficit disorder and autism may actually be suffering from mercury poisoning. And so that's what we want to see, whether or not there is proof of this, because every time we turn around, the FDA is telling us there is no proof. There is no proof. I believe there is proof. I believe that it's not just circumstantial proof. I believe that they're doing everything they can, as they did with DDT and as they did with Oriflex and other diethylstilbestrol and Dacon Shield and Copper Coil 7 and these other things that have hurt people. They've danced away from doing anything about it. Even MSG, they kept bouncing it back from the FDA to the National Academy of Sciences. And when I did an investigation at the time, I found that several of the members sitting on the so-called Blue Ribbon Advisory Panel actually work for MSG manufacturers. So I do not trust the objectivity of the FDA unchallenged. I believe that whatever they share, and there are good and honest people at the FDA, but I want to see at the policy level where things are actually done that there's no connection between what they say and special interest group pressure. Do we have Dr. Geier? All right. We'll go to him in just a second. Well, we're getting him, and as soon as he gets up, I'll let you know he's up. Let me mention some of the latest in the areas of health and nutrition update. For all of you who've heard me talking over the many years about the power of our attitude, some really good news in the current issue of Psychology and Aging. A study, the first study, University of Texas, tackled the idea of tracking 1,558 older Mexican-Americans in five southwestern states for 7 years. They found those with positive emotions were much less likely to become frail over time. And so there's an article about this showing that you can maintain homeostasis balance and better chemical and neurological response if you're positive. And in a second study, North Carolina State University researchers found negative stereotypes about aging resulted in a decline of older people's memory performance. So if you believe that getting old is going to diminish you, you're right. And if you believe that being positive is going to keep you younger, you're right. So both are right, but look at the tremendous difference in the consequences. Two good studies in two peer-reviewed journals. Now we have Dr. Geier on the phone. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi. It's David Geier.
Hi, David. David, let's go right into the topic here at hand. What do you believe or can you prove is the link between mercury and vaccines? And what is the evidence that mercury damages nerve cells?
Well, mercury is clearly one of the most toxic substances on the planet. It's recognized as a neurotoxin by various environmental organizations, including the California State EPA, has officially declared that thimerosal, which is 50% mercury by weight, is a known is a developmental and reproductive toxin. What I've done, and I've worked with my father, Dr. Mark Geier, we've done a series of studies where we've evaluated children receiving thimerosal-containing vaccines, thimerosal-free vaccines. And the results of our studies have shown that there's a major increased risk for developing neurodevelopmental disorders in those children getting thimerosal-containing vaccines. And there have been a series of molecular studies now and animal studies demonstrating that thimerosal can directly cause autistic-like features both in animals and tissue culture cells.
Okay, good. I'm going to ask you to speak up, please. We're having some technical challenges today. What is the evidence of causation that mercury leads to autism?
Well, it takes the form of There are epidemiological studies like what I mentioned that we've done on large population databases. And those studies show the more mercury, more thimerosal, in other words, the children got, the more risk they had of these neurodevelopmental disorders. Then there are studies where they took mice. This comes from Dr. Maddie Horning at Columbia University. Took mice, gave them thimerosal mirroring the childhood immunization schedule, both in dose and in timing, and she induced in the mice actual autistic features. And then other studies have demonstrated that at less than one part per billion, that thimerosal and mercury can cause neurons in tissue culture significantly degenerate, much like is what's seen in the brains of autistic children.
What would be the level of mercury necessary to cause a problem, and why is it that we have so much mercury today compared to in previous decades when it comes to mercury exposure?
Well, the level, there really is no safe level of mercury exposure. That's the first thing to know. Having any mercury around poses a real risk. The EPA, as an example, has set some cutoffs for mercury exposure. They say that 0.1 micrograms of mercury per kilogram body weight per day is an acceptable exposure to mercury. It should be noted that at that level, even at that low level, it's been demonstrated in some tissue culture studies that mercury can cause damage to neurons. But to give you an idea how much mercury the children were receiving from their childhood vaccines, they were receiving over 100-fold in excess of that safety guideline. And this goes sort of answers your second question as well. The big change that occurred in this country that apparently contributed to the massive wave of neurodevelopmental disorders affecting this country began in 1990-91 when the amount of mercury in vaccines effectively tripled. And it wasn't that people began adding more mercury to any one given vaccine. It was simply that more and more of these wonderful life-saving vaccines were added to the childhood immunization schedule. But nobody added up the fact that when you added all these new shots, that there was much more mercury. And when this new schedule was implemented, just to give you an idea, a newborn infant, that's when the new vaccine schedule began to be administered, received a hepatitis B vaccine that had 12.5 micrograms of mercury. And according to that EPA guideline, the children weighed about 3 kilograms, approximately 7 pounds, so they were allowed 0.3 micrograms, got 12.5 micrograms, approximately 40-fold in excess of that EPA guideline. Then at 2 months, under the new schedule, things got much worse. Children got a hepatitis B vaccine that had 12.5. They got a Haemophilus influenza or HIB vaccine that had 25 micrograms, and they got a DPT or DTaP shot with 25 more. And at 2 months, they weighed about approximately 5 kilograms, about 12 pounds. So they were allowed 0.5. They got 62.5 from their vaccine. Now they were more than 129-fold over the EPA guideline. And this trend continued at 4 months. They got more, 6 months more, and so on.
Well, put it in perspective. There was a time when you'd get two vaccines or three. And you didn't have a whole lot of reactions. Then they started to up the amount of vaccines, and we thought it was a lot when kids were getting 10. And then by the 1990s, they were getting 20. Now it's proposed they get 40. And it seems to be that there's no limit to what they're willing to do to put pathogens, bacteria, viruses, and contaminants into children's bodies. And we don't have anyone as a major voice there protecting us within the FDA, the CDC. We do have some voices within Congress, but very few, because most have been receiving financial contributions from pharmaceutical industries. And even in the sham hearings that are frequently held, the doctors and scientists are selected from the industries to go forth and spread the good word. You rarely have an opportunity to hear the activists who come forward, because there's a bias that if the activists are not as credentialed as those who are supporting an industry position, then they're not credible, as if the only credible people are people with the credentials of an industry behind them. And if you are credentialed, but you have gone against the industry, you're discredited. So it's really a stacked house as far as getting the information out that we're over-vaccinating children. Vaccination is not the same as immunization. Many vaccines have contained mercury at very high levels, and no one's going back to the tens of millions of children who were vaccinated over the decades with that thimerosal in multiple injections and checking to see if there is any connection between those vaccines and later developmental problems that may have occurred, or immunological problems that may have occurred, or neurological problems that may have occurred. It's as if we're saying, well, the problem didn't exist because we don't recognize it. That's very irresponsible. That's my position. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree that the FDA in their own internal memos acknowledges regarding the thimerosal issue that they were asleep at the switch. They never bothered to add up the amount of mercury children were receiving. And so it never dawned on them when they added all these new shots that children were so much over the federal safety guidelines. And after they did the math, this was in summer of 1999, they found, just like what I've been telling you, that the children were way overdosed with mercury. And they did take the prudent step at the time to recommend removing mercury from some of these vaccines. But the problem has been that, really, they never required it. There was no formal recall of thimerosal, and the vaccine manufacturers themselves have just gone on and continued to make many childhood vaccines with thimerosal in them. So we haven't been able to end this tragedy. And I agree about, again, this is further support, I guess, this position of sort of institutional malfeasance. Congress, the Government Reform Committee specifically, has issued a report following their 3 years of investigation and have found the FDA and CDC guilty of institutional malfeasance for their handling of this issue, for self-protectionism and misplaced protectionism of the pharmaceutical industry. So I think that there is something significant here, and I think it's starting to come out and be more accepted in the mainstream world that there was a terrible tragedy that FDA and CDC allowed to happen. They, in many cases, have protected us, I think, against a lot of nasty diseases, but in this case, they simply weren't doing their job.
Well, it's not just a matter of not doing their job. It's a matter of, look at all the people who have been affected. We're talking about tens of millions, not a few hundred, not a few thousand. And they have not done anything to recognize their responsibility. You couldn't have done that by accident. You would have to be protecting an industry. And you could only protect the industry if you had pressure placed by that industry upon you to protect it. And of course, when you're the most powerful, when you're a regulatory agency, you have the power of regulation. With that comes a moral imperative. It is not being exercised in a way that serves the interest of the public. And I think that the entire FDA should have a shake-up from top to bottom, and that there should be a truth committee of Congress that allows 100% protection of anyone who comes forward, and also give them 100% indemnification. In effect, you waive all criminal proceedings against them if they tell the truth, and then see what evidence comes out of the halls of the FDA and the CDC about conflicts of interest and behind-the-scenes deals and pressure from powerful lobbyists and scientists and payoffs. And the whole history of the FDA is one big cesspool. It is utterly corrupt in its philosophy, and yet there has never been a major shakeup at the FDA. And it's like the IRS. It has power it shouldn't have, and it directly impacts upon our lives. And until we exercise people power, but we don't have our people's legislators who are willing to be there on our behalf. It's just a joke to watch these people campaign. All they want is our vote, and then we become invisible again. The system is corrupt, and it's flawed, and it's not good, and it has to be changed. And the only way we can change it is recognize the problems. And I believe in giving immunity. If people come forward, but you have to have the courage to come forward, they don't want to know the truth, or they'd have such a hearings. South Africa had hearings. Other countries have had hearings. Chile had hearings. But we won't, because we don't realize, or we don't want to accept, that we have as much corruption as we do. I want to thank you very much for your work and your father's work in the field of enlightening us on the importance of these issues.
Sure, thank you for having me.
And that's Dr. Mark Geyer. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.